Moon Science and Curious Space. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration, recorded here at Jetsons Live. Hey there, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's Artemis II mission could be just days away from launching a crew of four astronauts on a trip around the moon and back. It will mark a new chapter of human lunar exploration and continue a renewed interest in the science of the moon. We'll speak with UCF's Addie Dove and Carrie Donaldson-Hannock about the scientific discoveries ahead on the lunar surface. Then it's time for Curious Space. We got a fresh batch of questions from kids for veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott, and we'll turn the mic over for a Q&A from the audience here at Jetsons Live. That's ahead on Space on Tap, a special event series from Are We There Yet? As I mentioned, NASA's Artemis II program could hit a big milestone as soon as April 1st. It'd be the first human mission to launch the moon since the Apollo 17 mission in 1972. There's fresh excitement about new human moon missions, but excitement for the moon has never waned, right? So to talk about the moon and a payload that is heading to the moon soon, we've got Addie and Carrie to talk about it. Before we get into something fun I have planned for us, why is the moon so cool these days?
The moon's always been cool. I decided to study the moon when I was in grad school, and it was back when it was the Constellation missions going to the moon, and some people did make fun of me. They were like, why would you want to do that? It's never going to go anywhere. But I study dust on the moon, right? So I study a really exciting topic, which is just like dust in space. But it's just this, it's our nearest neighbor, and it's just this fascinating testbed for all of these things that we can study about basic physical processes, but also the history of the solar system.
Well, and we can see the moon every night. Like, how cool is it to be able to look up in the night sky and see what you want to study? And you know, you can use with your own eyes or with binoculars or telescopes to really see, like, that's the cool place that I want to go. Like Addie, I started studying the moon in grad school and was also working on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter at the time and starting to think about what are all the cool rocks up there. And so now, you know, we're pretty lucky now to be thinking about sending our own mission in a few years to one of those cool spots.
We're going to talk about that mission, but I want to play a game first that that I came up with. And it's called Moon or False, or True or False. So Addie and Carrie have crafted some statements about the moon. Some are true. Others are false. There's water on the moon.
True.
False. Who said false? False? Who says false? Who says true?
Well, there's a lot of evidence that there might be water on the moon.
That was a very scientific answer.
Yeah, so there's lots of evidence, but we actually haven't detected the exact ice or water deposits. And so there's a lot of interesting lines of evidence, but we haven't actually measured it directly yet. So probably.
Yeah. Okay. Why is that important, Addie?
I mean, so water is important. Hopefully some folks have water on their table here tonight, right? Water is a pretty essential thing for life on Earth, but it's also really important for exploration. The presence of water means there's hydrogen and oxygen, which means it can be used for resources on the lunar surface. And again, it's just like one of those things where it helps us understand if we can live there and maybe make use of the resources when we're there.
And it's not like water on the table, though, right?
It's not going to be like water on the table.
Yeah, you can't ice skate on the moon.
No.
No. This one's going to be a tough one. It was for me. The rocks on the moon are only shades of gray.
It's false. Yeah, when we look at the moon, we see mostly shades of gray. But there's volcanic glasses that come in shades of red, orange, yellow, and green.
Does that help us know what the moon is made of?
Yeah, it tells us about the minerals on the inside of the moon.
And also some about how they might have formed. So like the orange glass beads are probably formed from volcanic mechanisms, for instance. So.
And is this something you could see with the naked eye on the surface of the moon? Or is this what we're talking very tiny?
You can see, you would need to look at some of the old Apollo images, and you can definitely see the orange glasses coating the surface. And that's how the Apollo astronauts identified and said, we need to go collect samples there. It's because they could actually see something that wasn't gray.
Really?
And they knew that that was very different and needed to sample it.
Huh, very cool. All right, speaking of Apollo, if put side by side, all the Apollo lunar landing sites would fit in the continental U.S.,
this was a good stumper.
This was a stumper, yeah.
This was a stumper.
It's true, right? Where did they go?
Yeah, so if you look at where the Apollo missions are on the lunar surface, they're all on the near side. They're all on the side that faces the Earth, and they're all roughly equatorial, so sort of in the middle of the moon. And so actually where they're distributed on the lunar surface, and the moon's much smaller than the Earth, right? So that all in all of that area together is about the size of the continental U.S.
And to put it into context, the Apollo 11 landing site would fit in a soccer field. Or about a baseball diamond. And the Apollo 17 landing site would fit inside of Paris.
Well, all right, so where's Artemis going then? Is it going back to the same spot that Apollo went to?
It's not. So the Artemis missions are currently planned to go to the South Polar region. So this is an area that's going to be very different than the equatorial regions we've previously been to. It's obviously, as it sounds like, it's down in the South Polar region. They haven't picked the exact site for the first human landing yet, but there's a few sites that are identified.
That leads us to our next statement. The lunar South Pole has some of the coldest temperatures in the entire solar system. Everyone said false. True over there?
Yeah.
What is it, experts?
It's true.
Really?
Yeah. So the Diviner Lunar Radiometer, which is on board the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, measured temperatures of the South Pole and the North Pole. And there are areas that get down to 40 Kelvin, which is as cold as some of the outer planetary bodies in space. And it's because there's areas that get no sunlight. And so if you don't get any sunlight, you stay pretty cold.
The moon doesn't have an atmosphere, so there's no sort of equilibration across the surface. So if you're not in sunlight, it's very, very cold. If you are in sunlight, it's very, very hot.
Well, that leads to, maybe you can't answer this question, but why are we sending astronauts there in the first place? That's like a terrible place to go, right?
Well, we're not sending them to those regions.
Okay.
So we're not going to send them down into, it's called a permanently shadowed region, a PSR. We're not going to send an astronaut into a PSR, although some of us would like to. That would be really interesting. Yeah. But for safety reasons, we won't do that the first time.
Okay.
Yeah. And so they're probably going to go to areas that are predominantly sunlit, actually, because over the sort of week of the mission, they want to be in an area where there's sunlight and direct communications with Earth.
But the permanently shadowed regions is where we think there's water.
Okay.
And so those are cold enough to store the reservoirs of water that we're hoping to find.
Anybody brave enough in this room to go for Addie to look around? No.
We can send robots first.
Okay. So well,
scale down the sides of a crater into these dark regions and then bring some of the ice back up, in theory.
Okay. But, I mean, these rovers need sunlight for energy,
right? They can
have
batteries.
They can have batteries, but it's also very harsh. Can you?
They can charge in the sunlight and then drive down, get some ice, and bring it back up potentially.
But some of the aerospace companies have been demonstrating surviving the night, the lunar night. And so some of the companies are already testing that capability of being able to be in those cold of temperatures.
You may one day have your astronaut there. There is active volcanism on the moon. First of all, what is volcanism?
What do you think?
Volcanoes?
Yeah.
Okay. There are active volcanoes on the moon. Look at me.
It could relate to Spock.
What do y'all think? Are there active volcanoes on the moon? True.
I feel like it's like a...
Yeah. No, this is a very split room. Yeah. It's false.
It's false.
Right? But there was volcanism there, right?
Yeah.
And that's what you all want to study, right?
Yeah, there's several different kinds of volcanism on the moon. When you look at the moon at night and you see the really dark, large expanses on the near side, those are all ancient volcanoes that have flowed and covered, filled in the basins. But what we're interested in is actually looking at smaller volcanic features called silicic features. And in particular, we want to go to the Grutaisen domes. And so these are odd little volcanic features that are similar to places that we see on Earth, like Mount St. Helens. And so we want to send our instruments to figure out how they formed.
Can you say that again? Where are you going?
To the Grutaisen domes. We're going to Mons Grutaisen Gamma.
If you ever listen to a conversation I have with Carrie on the show, I never say it, and I make her say that word. So. And tell us about the mission that you are sending there, the instrument.
Addie and I are leading. So I'm the principal investigator. Addie is the deputy principal investigator. And we have developed a suite of instruments that will go on a lander and a rover to land on the Grutaisen Gamma Dome. And that rover is going to drive around with multispectral cameras and a gamma ray and neutron spectrometer and figure out what types of elements and minerals are making up that dome, which will tell us how they formed.
Cool. All right.
The mission's called LunarVise.
And
we're hopefully going to the surface in 2028.
All right. The moon's surface is pummeled by impactors, even today. We're talking about things that are actually hitting it, like asteroids and stuff. Yeah. True?
That's true.
Good job. True. It's true. Yeah.
How are you going to protect lunar vice from that stuff?
I know.
It's a risk.
It's a risk. So the big impacts that created, like the craters we see and most of the big craters we see, happened a long time ago. But we actually have data from ground-based telescopes that see little flashes on the surface occasionally. And their Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's been orbiting the moon for over a decade has been taking images of the same sites over and over again. And we see fresh new craters appear every once in a while. So there's tiny little stuff that hits and then slightly bigger stuff.
There's an active rover on the far side of the moon. Is that true or false? Yes. False. Reverse false here.
It's true.
It's true.
Yeah, there's a Chinese rover on the far side of the moon still driving around. It's been there for a couple of years now, exploring the south polar region on the far side of the moon.
Do we know what it's found?
Some dirt and some rocks. No, there's actually been a lot of really awesome science papers that have come out from it. The little rover is called U22 because it was the second one. And it's been driving around. It has some cameras on it. It's been trying to look a little bit at the subsurface and telling us about sort of the history of that region. And it's in the south polar region, so it's got some interesting geology results.
Yeah, and there's even volcanism in that area. And so they've dated the volcanism on the far side of the moon.
That means there's volcanoes there.
Yeah,
Annie.
Exactly. Yeah.
I know. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, here's the final one. Okay. Human eyes first looked at the far side of the moon on Apollo 17. False.
That was some pretty confident falses.
That was some pretty confident. Yeah.
Which
one was it?
A lot of silence also.
Apollo 8.
Apollo 8.
That was great. Well done.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is about to change, right? With Artemis 2, the first human eyes may have this view that we got here from Artemis 1. Addie, Carrie, we're about to enter this new era of human space exploration with Artemis 2. What are you most excited for over the next decade?
Yeah, I'm excited for humans to be back at the moon and having not only just going back, but having a sustained presence and what science that's going to enable, especially on the far side of the moon. We know a lot about the moon from all the samples that the Apollo astronauts returned, but that's nothing like the samples that are on the far side.
And even the South Polar region is very different than the equatorial regions we've previously explored. So the first Artemis missions that go there will bring back really unique samples as well. This first Artemis 2 mission will be the first time humanized since Apollo 17. Have seen with the human eyes on the far side. So that'll be really exciting. I think the other thing that is exciting for us and is part of what we're involved in is that, like, along with the human missions comes a lot of scientific exploration, whether that's by the humans or by robotic precursors or by robotic things they'll bring with them. And so there's just a lot of opportunity for science and understanding our companion in the sky and also our place in the solar system.
Addie and Carrie, thank you so much for joining us. Please join me in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Space on Tap, a special event series from Are We There Yet? This show was recorded live on Monday, March 23rd at Judson's Live at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts. Still to come, Curious Space, veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott answers kids' questions about space. That's just ahead on Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. You're listening to Space on Tap, a special event series from Are We There Yet? And Central Florida Public Media. This show was recorded live on Monday, March 23rd at Judson's Live at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts in Orlando. Veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott joined us for a live taping of Curious Space. Here's that conversation now.
Winston Scott, veteran NASA astronaut, who is our Curious Space resident expert. For people who don't know Curious Space, where we take inquisitive questions from our youngest space fans and put them to somebody who has actually been to space. That is you, Winston. We're going to start with Emily.
How overwhelming is the liftoff, how and why?
You go from sitting on the launch pad to 17,500 miles per hour in only 8.5 minutes. The action starts about 7 seconds before the clock hits zero. The ground launch sequence, the computer would ignite the three space shuttle main engines. And you're shaking and vibrating, there's smoke and fire billowing up around the front windscreen. And then when the clock hits zero, the solid rocket boosters ignite, and then you're off to the races. It looks like slow motion on TV or videos. Look like rockets sort of float up in slow motion. In reality, they kick you in the butt. Surprised me on my first flight. I thought we were going to float up in slow motion. We passed 100 miles per hour in about 45 seconds, thereabout. passed Mach 1, the speed of sound, roughly 40. We passed 100 miles per hour before we cleared the tower. We passed Mach 1 in roughly 43, 45 seconds, and then we continue to go faster, Mach 2, Mach 3, Mach 5, Mach 6, Mach 8, Mach 10, Mach 12, and so on. I always like to tell this. My first flight was at night, but about halfway through the ascent, I could look out of the front windows and see the day half of the Earth coming. So we launched that night, and there's the day half. We go through the terminator, that line between night and day, and into daylight before we ever reach orbit. It is an eye-watering ride, no doubt about it.
Wow. Yeah. It took me 36 minutes to get here today, and it takes you 8.5 minutes to get to space. This one comes from Daniel.
How painful is it when you go for a splashdown?
Yeah, I didn't splash down. I came down in the shuttle, so we landed like an airplane. It's a nice, smooth landing, as a matter of fact. Feels almost like an airliner touching down. But the folks that do come down on capsules, it's not painful at all. The landing is cushioned because, after all, you don't want to injure astronauts on landing. They've been in space for how many long they've been up there. Capsules that come down in the water are cushioned, typically with floats or airbags or whatever. And the same thing with the land landings. The Russians' capsules that come down have retro jets. As the parachutes of the capsule approaches the land, the jets fire to further slow the descent so that they can touch down in a nice, smooth manner. There was one touchdown a few years ago that was a little bit hard that resulted in some minor injuries, but again, they're all cushioned.
All right, this one comes from Ivy.
What is something you didn't expect in space?
Oh, everything is different in space. The first thing you don't expect is how zero gravity feels. Again, I can't make you feel continuous weightlessness. But other things you don't expect in space is just how the Earth looks from up there. It looks so small and so fragile, so bright and so colorful and so beautiful. And you don't see any turmoil. It looks very, very peaceful.
All right, here's our next one from Nora.
What does it feel like to be in a spacesuit?
Oh, well, it depends on the spacesuit. The orange suits that we wear on launch and recovery are called launch and entry suits, and they are partial pressure suits. They probably weigh about 50 pounds, I guess. I was a spacewalker, so I got to put the spacesuit and go outside. That's the EMU, extravehicular mobility unit. That thing weighs over 300 pounds on Earth. It is massive. Now, space is an amazing place because up there it doesn't weigh anything, but you still have the 300-plus pounds of mass on your body, and you're moving that, you're moving your body mass, you're moving your tools. So physically speaking, the most difficult thing we do is spacewalking. And the suit is big and bulky and cumbersome, and it resists every move that you make. So it takes a lot of training and practice and conditioning to perform the spacewalk.
It looks pretty smooth when you do it, though. So
well,
you look smooth.
Yeah. Yeah. Appearance is everything.
All right, this one's from Isabella.
Astronaut, are you having fun? By Isabella.
I would also like to know, Winston, are you having fun?
I most
right now?
Certainly am having fun. Are you all having fun? All right, good deal.
All right, thank you, Isabella, for that check-in. Here's London.
Why does astronauts have to go in space?
Why do astronauts have to go in space?
That's a really good question. And when you see pictures come back and we're playing with food and throwing stuff all around, you might just say, well, those guys are up there just having a ball. But as we discussed earlier, going back to the moon, how important that is. Well, going into space is important for many, many, many different reasons. First of all, it's our nature. You know, we were created to be curious creatures, we human beings. But second of all, is that if the human race is going to survive, if human beings are going to survive as a species, we have to find another planet to live on. Because one of these days, billions of years from now, we'll all be gone, but our descendants will be here. The Earth will be uninhabitable. And if human beings are going to survive, we need another planet. Many, 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 many reasons, but primarily, if we're going to survive as a species, we gotta go.
That's a great segue for Aiden's question.
Have you seen aliens?
In all seriousness, no, I have not seen any aliens, but I always like to change that question around and ask the audience, how many of you believe that there is life someplace else in the universe? All right, get those hands up there. I believe in the odds. With billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of planets, there's got to be life someplace else in the universe.
All right, we got two more. Here we go.
Did any of your spacecrafts ever collide with space garbage?
Hey, you know, that's a good question. And the answer, space garbage, no. Space debris, yes. Fortunately, the debris we hit were micrometeorites. It wasn't uncommon to bring the space shuttle home and you have micrometeorite damage. In fact, I flew on Columbia. One of my flights was Endeavor. My other flight was on Columbia. Remember, we lost Columbia in 2003. When they lost Columbia and they went back to research the history of Columbia, my Columbia flight had some of the heaviest tile damage, and the tile damage came from our collisions with micrometeorites. So it was not unusual to have to change the front windshields on the shuttle or change tiles because we collide with micrometeorites. There's other debris in space. On my first flight with Brian Duffy, we were given a maneuver to keep the shuttle away from an old dead satellite. We didn't see it with our naked eyes. The ground saw it on radar. We maneuvered to stay away from it. So yeah, there's debris up there, trash up there, and becoming more and more stuff becoming prevalent up there. So space debris and how to combat it is going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that question because we've been covering that on the show quite a bit because it is becoming such a
right.
big problem.
Okay? Absolutely.
Especially for not only our satellites, but for people like you when we send you up to space.
Yeah. You know, let me throw one other thing. I was mentioning the fact that I was a spacewalker. When we perform an EVA, a spacewalk, we try and work in the wake of the shuttle or the space station. You try to hide behind its structure. So if something hits, it will hit the structure of the station or the shuttle and not hit us. One other thing, I mentioned the EMU, the space suit that I wore outside. The upper part is called the hard upper torso that covers the vital organs, the heart, lungs, and so on. It's made out of Kevlar, the bulletproof vest stuff. And the idea is that if a micrometeorite hits you, hopefully that Kevlar will protect your vital organs. So all of these things are very, very important to successful and safe spaceflight.
Important and terrifying. So that is awful. All right, Winston. Here's our last question from our young listeners.
Who inspired you to go to space?
A number of reasons. First and foremost, it was a nice next step up from what I was already doing in the Navy. I was a naval aviator by background, flew fighters in the Navy, became a research and development testing evaluation pilot. So got to fly and test new systems. Well, the next step up, the highest you can go as a pilot, as an aviator, is to fly in space. So that's one reason. I'm always looking for new challenges. But a more important reason is it's a way to contribute. And I think we all want to in some way contribute to life here on Earth. And the things that we learn in space all benefit each and every one of us on Earth.
Yeah. Thank you, Winston. We're going to turn it over to you all now. This gentleman right here in the front.
As a naval aviator, what was your call sign? You talked about who?
Yeah, somebody asked me that and before. My call sign was Slick. Has nothing to do with my integrity. My wife is here with me. Our son is. I flew Tomcats mostly in the Navy, and they called it the Top Gun airplane because of the original movie. Our son is on active duty. He's a naval aviator, flies Super Hornets, and he commanded a fighter squadron, and he most recently commanded the air wing aboard the aircraft carrier Carl Vinson. His call sign is Stoner. He's Winston Stoner.
Hi, Winston.
Hi.
I was just curious. Once you were liftoff, what was the maximum G-force you encountered?
Yeah, the maximum G-force you encounter are 3 Gs. We fly 3 Gs because 3 Gs transverse. That means it's this way. Positive G is coming down in your head. Negative G is what you feel when you go down a roller coaster suddenly and your stomach comes up. Transverse G is this way. The human body can take a lot more transverse G over a longer period of time than positive or negative. That's why astronauts lie down in a rocket so that the G forces would be this way.
What was your day like in there? Did you work 16 hours, sleep 8? Did you sleep in bits and pieces? How was your day?
It was our tax
structure.
Dollars. I hope you were working 16 hours.
Absolutely. We worked 26 hours.
That's what I want to hear as an American taxpayer.
But no, you're right, though. Everything you do in space is timelined, okay? You can't go to bed, for example, when it gets dark, the way you do down here, and get up when it gets light, because you circle the Earth every 90 minutes. So you've got 16 sunrises and sunsets. So everything you do is by timeline. So we're awake for 16 hours of the day. We have the lights on in the shuttle, the shades are down off the windows, and we're working, performing experiments or tasks or public relations, whatever we're doing. When it's time to go to sleep, you turn the lights down, you put shades over the windows, you pretend it's nighttime and try and sleep. In the meantime, the sun's going up and down and up and down and up and down. A typical day up there is not too different from here in some ways. You wake up, obviously you have to bathe, and the guys all shave and so on. We prepare breakfast, we eat, and then we go to our various timelines. Somebody may be doing an experiment over here. Somebody may be doing something else over there. If it's a spacewalking day, that takes up everything. You stop for lunch, you prepare your food, eat, then some more work, and then dinner, and so on, until it's time to go to bed. So in some ways, similar to here.
Captain Scott, I was wondering throughout your career what you've found to be most fulfilling throughout your career, and then also what's most fun.
Oh, my goodness. But my entire career has been very fulfilling. My days in the Navy as a naval aviator and flying in space. I would say most fulfilling is professionally, certainly is flying in space. You know, being so fortunate to have been selected to fly in space. That's been the most fulfilling. But what's important, you know, the older you get, the more philosophical you become. What's really fulfilling is not so much that I did it, but I get the chance to come back and share it with other people, especially young people. You know, that really is the fulfilling part, because the kids are our future, and we want them to be inspired to go off and do great things for us all. So that's probably the most fulfilling part for me.
What other entertainment options did you have on board for free time?
Oh, man, your entertainment is limited only by your imagination. We held Olympics in space. Representing Ukraine was Leonid Kadinyak. We spread Leonid out in midair. He was floating horizontally in midair, and we spun him around. And we counted the number of turns he made before he bumped into something. Representing the United States was Steve Lindsay. We put Spread Steve out, and we spun him around. Representing India was Dr. Kalpana Chawla. We spread, who called a KC. We spread KC out in space and spun her around and counted the number of turns she made before KC won our Olympics.
I love it. And I'm sure a few papers were written on those findings.
That was actually a great scientific experiment we were doing.
Please join me in thanking Winston Scott for such a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much.
That's going to do it for this episode of Space on Tap, a special event series from Are We There Yet? And Central Florida Public Media. This show was recorded live on Monday, March 23rd at Judson's Live, the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts. Take part in the next event. Find details at cfpublic.org/spaceontap. And if you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. If you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Additional production assistance for Space on Tap comes from Rebecca Fernandez. TJ Barnes engineered this show. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.